Hey, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the program that invites you to leap out of the box of conventional thinking and soar into the zone of free mind. That's what we do on this radio show, bringing you some of the real experts that have insights as to the human condition, what's going on in our planet and beyond, and what we can look forward to as we move ahead. Today we're speaking to someone, I think you've got a lot to tell us about something that's on our minds, and that is, as we watch a lot of the structures falling down of what we have considered those structures that give us a sense of security and our history, what we've worked with for so long, what will the future hold? And the book today is called The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. And the author and my guest is Thomas Greco, a fellow Italiano. So, Thomas, thank you for being with me today. Sorry for the delay in getting started.
No, my pleasure, Patricia.
Well, I will admit that I have not been able to get through your whole book. But as I dive into it, I just felt that this was such an exciting topic for my audience, which, by the way, will play again on Saturday. So people will be hearing this interview twice. And for that reason, I invite you to really just go to the absolute nut of what you're bringing through in this book. So let's start with this. It's such a huge topic, and it's, of course, so timely. Can you give us an overview of why, what your background is and why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I started researching the money and banking problem back 30 years ago. And the reason I focus so much on money and banking is because I realize that it is one of the central mechanisms by which power is concentrated and wealth is concentrated in the hands of fewer people. And so I started writing about it about 20 years ago, and my first book was called Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis. And in that book, I outlined the nature of the dysfunctional money system and put forth a few principles that I thought should be applied in developing a more functional one. And then a few years later, I wrote another book called New Money for Healthy Communities, which looked at alternative exchange mechanisms that have been used historically and were being used at that particular time. That was in 1994. Then I revised that book and published it through Chelsea Green under a new title, and that was a larger, expanded, improved version. It was called Money.
And I would imagine that you were able to pull from the global situation that is so current now to be able to enhance what you had already written so long, which you had foreseen before.
Absolutely. This latest book, as you mentioned.
Let's talk about this global control. I feel manipulated global collapse economically, but of course I'm not an expert as you are, but I am intrigued by the fact that you go into the concept of the New World Order and how this is all being played out for, as you said, a handful of people who, the elite, let's say, the financially elite, and most likely also the power elite. Can we get into that kind of knowledge as to how the whole thing is being manipulated to serve that very elite minority?
Sure. Well, we've been kept ignorant of the mechanisms by which money and banking work. Very few people really understand it. And there's a lot of obfuscatory rhetoric that is intended to keep people ignorant. When you look at the recent hearings in Congress where certain Congress people like, I forget the congressman from Florida, who, Alan Grayson, he's been questioning the leaders of the Federal Reserve and asking what they've been doing, and they've been reluctant to reveal that. And so that's an indication of how far out of control the system has gotten. And it goes
by because they're not only reluctant, they're almost refusing. And they seem to know that they can.
Well, they are refusing. It's a very arrogant stance that they're taking. It's like
exactly. They've
carved out this realm for themselves, and they are beyond the pale. It You know, it was sold to the people on the basis of we need an independent central bank so that money will not be manipulated by political interests. But actually, it has enabled the manipulation of money by political interests. So we have at this stage a central banking debt money system that has spread all over the world. Virtually every country in the world has a central bank, and the collusion between the bankers and the politicians amounts to this. The bankers get to lend money at interest, money that they create with simply a few bookkeeping entries, and the politicians get to spend as much money as they want without regard to tax revenues, and that money will be monetized by the central bank if necessary. So we have these two parasitic elements in the monetary system, interest and inflation. Inflation is the debasement of the currency by the monetization of government debt. So government debt creates new money when it's monetized, but there's no additional goods and services going into the economy. So that money represents empty dollars, so to speak. And it forces vendors to raise their prices in order to try to protect themselves from this legalized counterfeit.
Wow, that's heavy language. So we're talking about usury. I have trouble pronouncing that word.
Yes, usury is built into the system.
Exactly.
What goes by the name of interest is often really just usury. It's charged by the creators of money for the use of that money. So basically what we do, we've allowed the bankers to privatize the credit commons, as I call it. We give our credit to the banks, and then we beg them to lend some of it back to us, and they charge us for the privilege.
It's outrageous. How do you see this unfolding as we watch the government taking over the banks, taking over the private sector, and they're just, even though we hear the occasional cheering on messages from administration saying it's getting better, the bottom line is it isn't, or is it?
No, I don't think it is. I think it has a long way to go before it gets better, and I think the improvement is going to be highly limited as long as we have these current money and banking structures. If we're going to see any significant improvement, I think we're going to have to create alternative exchange structures and alternative mechanisms of finance. But you mentioned the government taking over the banks. That's really not the case. You know, it may look that way on the surface, but really, when you look at who's in charge, both the current Secretary of the Treasury in the United States and the previous one were both executives of Goldman Sachs, probably the most powerful financial institution in the United States and one of the most powerful in the world. So the question is, in whose interests are they operating? What is the Treasury doing that benefits the people? What is the Federal Reserve doing that benefits the people? It's really primarily for the benefit of the banking interests. With the bailout of the banks, we had the shift of private debt to the public sector. You know, the purpose of a central bank is to enable the monetization of government debt, which means inflation, and to enable a banking cartel to charge interest on money that they create basically out of thin air by making some bookkeeping entries. So we have this arrangement which has allowed a small group to capture not only control of the economy but also political control as well. So we have the trappings of democracy, but we have in reality a world that's run by a small group of elite who control money, banking, politics, finance. And
when you say we have the trappings of a democracy, what do you mean? It doesn't look like a democracy to me.
Well, they give us the option of voting once every few years for people who are pre-selected.
That's manipulated too.
Of course it is.
So what we have is the illusion. Or is that
I guess illusion would be a better choice of words, yes.
This is such an important information for people because one of the ways that people are stirred into this kind of obedience and allowing these things to occur is on the grandeur of terms like patriotism and the American way or whatever country, it's all the same, nationalistic thinking. But in reality, we are seeing a new world order taking hold.
It's true. The political powers have been talking about a new world order for decades now. And the question is, what do they have in mind when they talk about a new world order? They've been very thin on specifics about what it means. I would think
that they want to be not too specific so that it's in place before people start asking the right questions.
Right. They like us to think that there is no choice. You know, that's what they told us about globalization as it has been done, that there is no choice,
right,
that we have globalized in the way that they tell us to do it. But basically, the old world order, as I can discern it, is based on a belief in scarcity, on immutable and sinful human nature, on violent conflict, on command and control methods of imposing order, and on elite rule. And the new world order that they have in mind is just that, based on the same
beliefs. There's not very much new to it, is there?
Nothing new at all. It's further in the same direction that we've been going for probably three centuries now. What we need to do is to create a convivial new world order, and that's based on beliefs in abundance and sufficiency, belief in the collective intelligence and community self-government, the potential for human improvement, nonviolent conflict resolution, and distributive justice. And these are the kinds of systems that I'm trying to promote. And the characteristics of this kind of convivial new world order would be community-based and democratic structures, more cooperation and equitable distribution, greater sustainability, a regenerative and sustainable economy. And it would be supportive of universal human improvement, not just making things better for a few at the expense of the many. And it would be a peaceful world order where we cooperate more than we compete.
Do you see this as a potential, as a possible reality? And how do you see this taking hold?
I absolutely think it is a possible reality. And many people around the world are working toward it right now. Maybe not describing it entirely in those terms. But we have movements like the Green Movement, the Decentralist Movement, the Bioregional Movement, the Human Potential Movement. We've got the Transition Towns Movement. We've got many alternative exchange mechanisms and community currencies that have been popping up in places all over the world. And now with this current global financial crisis, people are really, really starting to sit up and take notice. And the flaws in the dominant system are being clearly revealed. And people are applying themselves and their energies to create these alternative structures. I liken it to a metamorphic process of the caterpillar into the butterfly. Now, this may be a bit speculative, but I think it's a good vision for us to take hold of and work toward.
And we are facing, and I do discuss a lot on my show, we are very close now to 2012, which whether or not you believe in or embrace the Mayan calendar, certainly it has been proven that this is the end of a galactic cycle and a beginning of another. Some people prefer to think of this as Armageddon. Others believe it's a new dawn. Regardless of your slant on this, it is unquestionably a time of galactic change, which is very exciting.
Yes,
and so it is interesting that, because the Mayans did predict that everything would, in a sense, crumble to be reborn into a higher vibration. And we are seeing the crumbling of a lot of institutions that we felt were infallible.
Well, I don't know what the Mayans had to say about it. I've looked a little bit at that, but I don't have deep understanding of what was being predicted there. But factually, we can see that our institutions are crumbling across the board. Our healthcare system fails to deliver healthcare. Our educational system fails to deliver adequate education. Our economy is based on continual imperative of growth, and that cannot continue indefinitely. You know, at some point, some things have to mature. Ecologists have studied insect and animal populations, and they can see very clearly that when a population grows exponentially, it eventually has to level off to a steady state, or it collapses catastrophically. So I think that's the kind of change that we're going through in our world. We have a multidimensional mega crisis, if you will. And that crisis is largely being driven by the compound interest formula, which is built into our monetary and banking system. Compound interest is an exponential growth function. That means it grows at an accelerating rate. And so if we're going to manage the transition to a steady state economy, where we're able to subsist on the available resources that we have, we need to change the way we do money and banking. And that's what my books have been all about.
Okay, now let's take that giant leap and talk about, because the title of your book is so compelling, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. And it really does invoke a sense of a whole new way of being on this planet. Can you give us some insights into your perceptions of what will replace the crumbling structure?
Yes. Well,
will you give us some insights into what you are proposing in the book?
Yes, of course. People often ask me, what do you mean by the end of money? Are we really going to have an economy without money? Well, yes and no. What I mean by the end of money is that money has been going through an evolutionary process. You know, we started with commodity monies like gold and silver ultimately, but prior to that we had all kinds of commodities that served as exchange media, hides, nails, bullets, sugar, salt, all kinds of things. Those commodity monies were generally useful commodities that people would accept in trade, knowing that they could pass them on later for something else that they might want. So, for example, when tobacco was used as money, as it was in the U.S. colonies before the Revolutionary War, people who had no use for tobacco would still accept it because there was a general demand for it, and they knew they could exchange it later for something they did want. So we evolved from commodity money to symbolic money, which was paper money that was simply a warehouse receipt for commodities on deposit somewhere, typically gold and silver coins on deposit in the bank. And then later on, banks discovered that they could create money based on people's credit. So they started issuing banknotes not only on the basis of gold and silver on deposit, but on the basis of other assets like a mortgage note or a signature note that you might sign and ask the bank to take as collateral for a loan. So this creation of credit money liberated us from the limitations of commodity money, but it also opened the door for greater abuses because it was less transparent. And bankers then started to issue paper money on the basis of collateral that had questionable value or no value at all, and on the basis of government debt, long-term government debt, that might never be repaid. So that basis of issue of money basically debased the value of all the money that was already in circulation. And so that's the process called inflation. So what we need to do is to reclaim the credit commons. We have to take control of our own credit in our own communities and allocate it according to humane values and equitable values that we ourselves choose. So what I'm talking about is a process called mutual credit clearing. And there is a history of this. The credit clearing process is nothing new. What I'm talking about is simply the general application of it in communities around the globe.
And how do these communities free themselves from the dictates of the Fed, who are in your pocket for a huge amount of your personal wealth and your personal income?
Well, the first thing we have to do is to liberate ourselves from dependence on the dollar, on the euro, on the yen, on any of these political currencies that are all managed pretty much in the same way by their respective central banks. And the way we do that is by organizing these credit clearing circles that I mentioned. And
so you're talking about communities that are creating their own currencies and that have just declared themselves in some way separatist from the federal system.
No, there doesn't have to be any declaration of separatism. It's simply an offering of an alternative way of paying for purchases.
So in other words, a barter-based economy.
That's what people generally think of it as, but it really isn't barter. Barter is one-on-one. I have something you want, you have something I want, we make a trade. That's barter.
Well, right, but some of the communities that are doing a barter-based system will give you, like, I think this is where you're leading, okay, I've got 10 bushels of wheat, I get tote credit for that to be used by in exchanging for other services or commodities.
Well, the credit originates only when you sell that to somebody else in the system. The best example we have of this is a credit clearing system that was organized in Switzerland during the Great Depression. It was called VIR. W-I-R. And VIR was started by the small and medium-sized businesses in Switzerland because at that time, Swiss francs, like other political currencies, were scarce. Banks were restricting the supply of credit to the commercial and productive sector. So these small business people got together and tried to figure out how can we continue to do business with one another even though we don't have any money. They all had products and services to sell, but there wasn't enough official money in circulation to mediate the exchanges. So they said, well, we'll just set up a system of accounts. When you sell something, your account will be credited. When you buy something, your account will be debited. So when you sell, your account increases. When you buy, your account decreases. So they organized this exchange system called VIR, and it's been operating now for more than 75 years, and it has been thriving over that whole period of time. Now, it's limited.
But how do they escape the government saying you've got a viable income from this product that you've sold? We want taxes.
Well, the tax issue is a separate issue. They still have to pay taxes, but that's not the point. The point is they can continue to do business even though none of them has Swiss francs.
Okay.
So they liberate themselves from the political money system to that extent that they simply use their own goods and services to pay for the goods and services that they buy. That's what mutual credit clearing is all about. So recent statistics that are available from the VIR indicate that they have upwards of 60,000 members nationwide throughout Switzerland. And they're conducting business on the order of about $1.3 billion equivalent every year. So this is a significant financial entity. And those kinds of entities also exist in other parts of the world. They're called commercial barter exchanges, even though barter is a misnomer. They're properly called commercial trade exchanges, and they enable business-to-business transactions using this credit clearing process. Now, there's no reason why we can't set up these credit clearing exchanges on a more generalized basis to involve employees and consumers and all kinds of businesses from the retail level to the wholesale level to the manufacturers down to the basic commodity producers. And this
This type of system does not allow the possibility of getting into debit status because you don't get even you don't get debit if you haven't got a basis of credit in your account, right?
Not so. You are allowed a line of credit, which means you can buy before you sell.
Oh,
so
this is wonderful.
Some issuers that have established themselves as credit worthy will be given the privilege of having an account that goes into the negative.
And who establishes that person's credibility or not?
Well, the community itself. That brings up another question as to how these exchange systems should be organized and managed. And they can be managed and organized as cooperatives or as private for-profit businesses. The commercial barter industry is largely organized as commercial for-profit businesses. But they still provide this credit clearing service, which is a valuable service to their members.
And what prevents this this arrangement or this situation, I can't think of it right, I guess organization, from also undergoing eventually corrupt management from private interests that want to somehow avert or divert it into a more standard or a conventional system? In other words, into a decision-making position as to being the ones who determine or not whether someone can have that status, and soon these individuals have too much of a voice in the way things are going.
Yes, this is a common problem, and we've seen it over and over again in human history, where the hired hands usurp the power and take over the privileges and rights of the owners.
A sort of banana republic.
Well, it could turn into that. The reason why we have the situation we have is because people have not taken responsibility for educating themselves and for asserting their own power in making sure that things are done properly. So what we have now, and part of this transition process, is people taking responsibility, learning what they need to know, and asserting their own power. Now, I talk about the money power being in the hands of the people because, as I said before, it's our credit that we give to the banks, and then we beg them to lend some of it back to us. So we can allocate our credit directly. But how do we organize these systems in a way that will prevent the usurpation of power and a small group from taking over? That's a whole other question entirely, and perhaps the best way to do it is to organize these systems as cooperatives, or if they're commercial systems for profit, make sure that we maintain a level playing field and competition in the industry.
Of course. It does seem like it's just waiting to be infiltrated by interests that do not want this sort of power in the hands of the people to proliferate.
Well, we've seen that in the past, too. You know, there were vested interests always that didn't want the slaves to be freed, that didn't want women to have the vote. And
that's right.
Those are the things that we have to contend with.
Hoping that we are intelligent enough to realize that if we don't make a change, everything will collapse.
Right, and it's important to stress the fact that by making these kinds of changes, everybody's going to be better off. The system as it stands is unsustainable, so those who think they're in charge are going to be in charge of nothing at all, ultimately. So we need to make these changes that empower communities and help us to transcend the dominant monetary paradigm.
Indeed. Well, I would like to suggest that it seems to me, in my humble experience, that humankind almost needs to get pushed to the brink before we rise to the occasion and rally, understanding that, it's like that night before your term paper is due, you realize you've got to do a 30-page paper. At least that describes my college career. But it does seem that we are at the brink of some kind of disaster, and that this urgency is finally awakening us to the reality that the time for enormous change is upon us.
Sure. So a crisis always brings opportunity, and it is, as you say, people don't act until they start to feel the pain and see that there is a necessity for change. You know, we have within us two impulses. We have the conservative impulse, which wants to keep things as they are, and we have the change impulse, which wants to explore and find something more interesting or something better.
Well, it's surprising that the conservative impulse wants to keep things as they are, considering, as you just said, that they will soon be in charge of, or 100% of nothing when it all comes down. The greed is just blinding.
The true conservatives are not the ones that are trying to maintain that status quo. You know, if you take people like Ron Paul, the congressman from Texas, you know, he's been trying to sound the alarm on this money system for ages. And he's starting to get an audience. People are paying attention to him, and
he's a conservative.
Well, he is a conservative. I mean, he's a true
Ron
conservative.
Paul?
Yes.
Whew.
And they're
giving him that description. I see him as such an avant-garde thinker. Doesn't fit in the conservative image.
He's certainly distinct from the conservatives, so-called, who have taken control of the Republican Party these days. But,
right.
You know, that's how words get taken over by vested interests for their own purpose.
It's so easy to devalue or hyper-exaggerate terminology. We do have to be careful with that. Okay, before we go on, I would like, for those of you who have just maybe tuned in after we started late, I'm interviewing Thomas H. Greco, Jr. His viewpoints are very important to us right now, and he expresses this in his book, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, which we are discussing today. Before we go on, Thomas, can you give us your website so that people can investigate your work?
Sure, find out
more about the book.
The main website is called reinventingmoney.com, and my blog, which contains more frequent updates, is beyondmoney.net, beyondmoney.net. So you can find all kinds of links and resources on both of those sites.
Okay, great. Now, we know that this is extremely timely because I don't run into anyone who is not going through major changes about their own personal security financially. So how do we speak to these people who are really, we're talking about theory and we're talking about potential realities and change. But how does this translate down to the person who has been laid off with no prospect of getting a job? What do we tell these people to give them a direction to follow to dig their way out?
Well, those are certainly difficult questions, and basically I think what people have to do is to organize themselves in their own communities to cooperate and collaborate and help one another through this transition period. As I alluded to before, I think we're going through a metamorphic change similar to the change from the caterpillar into the butterfly. And if you look at the behaviors of those two creatures, the caterpillar, actually, its purpose is to eat and to grow. And that's all it does. It eats and it grows and it gets bigger and bigger. And it goes through a process called molting, by which it sheds its skin and develops a new skin. And it may go through that process four or five times before it stops. But eventually it does stop eating. Its behavior can be very devastating during that caterpillar stage because it can completely defoliate plants in the process of growing. But it does at some point stop growing. There's something in its program that tells it to stop growing, and then it spins a cocoon and goes into a period where its body disintegrates virtually, and the caterpillar turns into a new creature, the butterfly, during this metamorphic process inside the cocoon. And what's going on is the imaginal cells or imaginal discs that form the butterfly body were there in the caterpillar's body all along. that they were dormant through the caterpillar stage. But when the caterpillar goes into the cocoon, these imaginal cells become active and start reproducing and organizing themselves into the organs that will form the new butterfly body. And at some point when that process is completed, the cocoon will be split open and the butterfly will come out and emerge. And the behavior of the butterfly is quite different from that of the caterpillar. The butterfly flies around. It sips nectar from flowers and pollinates them in the process, supporting their reproductive cycle. It has sex and continues its own reproductive cycle so that the females will lay eggs now, which will become caterpillars and start the cycle all over again. So if that's an apt metaphor for what we're going through today.
It is a very apt and very eloquently put. Thank you for that.
Thank you. If that's the kind of process that we're going through today, and I think it's useful to look at it that way, we should not look toward a restoration of things as they were. You know, in terms of the economy recovering, it is not recovering. We're moving to a steady state economy in which production will level off and we will better supply the essential needs of people and stop producing a lot of waste and things that people don't want or don't need. You know, there's a current debate in Congress about whether to fund a new fighter aircraft, and the Pentagon doesn't want it, and yet Congress is pushing for it because it supports the economies of the districts in which these congresspeople are located. So,
sure.
You know, we have to stop that kind of thing. And we have to stop producing junk. You know, the distance between the factory gate where products emerge and the landfill where products go at the end of their lives has become shorter and shorter over time. We have disposable this and disposable that. And up to now, the emphasis has been on increasing labor productivity. Well, we have to focus more on resource productivity. We have to get more value out of less stuff. More
and, of course,
valuable.
The way to do that is to reduce our consumption.
Yes, to consume those things that we really need. And the problem is that corporations... labor is a cost to them, and corporations maximize their profits by reducing costs and increasing revenues. If labor is a cost, they want to reduce their labor costs, so they go to the places where labor is desperate for work and income, and basically that's what happened in the United States and Europe over the last several decades. Manufacturing has gone to Asia, where labor is abundant and cheap. And so now the Western countries have very little in the way of manufacturing capacity left. And if we're going to recover economically, we have to focus on localization of production, producing more for local use rather than for export to distant markets. With the peak oil situation, we're going to see an increasing cost of transportation, which is going to favor local production for local use. And with the financial collapse, we're seeing economies now pull back in that direction as well. China, for example, has been greatly dependent on the U.S. market, and they've accumulated tremendous amount of U.S. dollars as a way of maintaining their sales into the U.S. market. But now they're looking at the prospect of those dollars becoming less and less valuable, so they're going to have to take a loss as the value of the dollar declines in relation to their own currency.
And they have to maintain a certain margin of dollars in their central system because they know if they try to revert out of the currency, the U.S. will pull back on trade, right?
No, the more severe penalty will be they will force the value of the dollar down, and that will make their exports to the U.S. markets more expensive. So one way or the other, they're going to have to reduce their emphasis on production for the export market and increase their emphasis on production for their domestic market.
Now, how does all of this relate to gold and silver? Many people believing, or even being instrumentalized into believing, that they should, you know, start to amass gold as some idea of some sense of security in this financial
That's a good question. And historically, when there have been financial disruptions and questions as to the value of political currency, people have fled to precious metals, gold and silver, as well as other commodities and collectibles and anything that isn't dollar-denominated or denominated in the currency of the country you happen to live in. Now, as a store of value, gold and silver may have a place in one's investment portfolio. However, as exchange media, I don't think we're going to go back to gold and silver. You know, we have these contradictory functions that money is supposed to serve. In Economics 101, you learn that money serves the functions of medium of exchange, store of value, and measure of value. Well, when gold and silver were the predominant forms of money, yes, it did serve all those three functions. But with credit money, that's not the case. Credit money is purely, or should be purely, an exchange medium. If you want to store value, you have to store it in another way. You buy a financial instrument like a corporate stock or a corporate bond or a CD at a bank or some other long-term financial instrument. Or you buy something like a physical commodity or real estate. So those are mainly the options that people have in trying to protect their nest egg. So maybe gold and silver.
They certainly are shaky at the moment, aren't they?
Certainly. Maybe gold and silver.
Of course, one of the things that I think that we are learning, which is at the basis of all spiritual teachings, is that nothing is permanent. And if you look at the Buddhist tradition, it's free yourself of possession because you can't hold on to it anyway. So here we see it playing out. Real estate, we see once the stronghold of any financial package for security was to have real estate, to have land, and we see that falling down. The government can even come in and take it from you anyway.
Well, that's true. There's always the possibility of government coercion and dispossessing people of whatever they happen to have. You know, in 1933...
It's remarkable that the government could just come in and say, sorry, here's a few bucks for your property, we're putting in a highway, ciao. And this is allowed all over the planet.
Yes, there's been tremendous abuse by governments of the privilege of eminent domain. And in 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt became president in the midst of the Great Depression, he called in the gold. He said, it's now illegal for Americans to hold gold. You must turn in your gold. And in return, they were given, I think it was $22 in paper currency for every ounce of gold. And as soon as all the gold came in, then the official exchange rate was jacked up to $35 an ounce. And it was only...
Do you foresee this happening, that people are going to be forced to turn back into their gold?
Could very well happen. I don't know.
I had a friend years ago who was a huge hoarder of old gold coins. And he told me that he got a letter from the bank that said that they were no longer allowed to store this in their safe deposit box.
Really?
And
how long ago was this?
I said, well, what does this mean? Are we being told that pretty soon you have to turn in your gold? And he said that yes, the government was saying that it wasn't legal to hoard gold.
Well,
do you know anything about this?
No, but that's the kind of situation you have to anticipate.
Wow.
And recently, you know, there was a private mint that was minting silver coins called Liberty Dollars. And they recently were raided and had their metal confiscated by the government. They were also issuing certificates that were redeemable for gold and silver. And that was in a private warehouse. And all of those metals were confiscated by the government. This was just a year or so ago.
Well, so that's what I meant earlier when I was saying that how can these alternative economies bloom without the Fed coming in and saying, thank you very much, and stopping it? Because, of course, they would have every reason to want to stop this this complementary currencies or the creation of these new structures of exchange.
It's true, and that's why people have to organize themselves and assert their rights.
Well, man, we've got a lot of work to do, people. It's so exciting to hear someone with your background and knowledge speaking to a truly spiritual slant on the fiscal situation, our personal security financially, something exactly timely, ultimately in the foreground of our experience right now on this planet.
Well, I've been posting a lot of things to my blogs, and if you go to beyondmoney.net, you'll see a lot more on these topics.
Well, let me ask you this, Thomas. How do you foresee some of the new things that are coming? For example, you talk in your book about the new web-based commerce. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a quick idea of where that's going?
Sure. You have things like eBay and Amazon.com and all of these online marketplaces that are growing by leaps and bounds and doing tremendous amounts of business. You know, I typically buy books at Amazon.com, and I buy a lot of things on eBay. So as we generalize those systems or similar systems and include not only an online marketplace but also combine them with social networks, with credit clearing payment systems, and with a new standard of value or unit of account, then we can create web-based exchange systems that are independent of the political money system as well. So this is another...
But don't you think Big Brother's going to step in and put a big government foot on that kind of exchange?
Well, it depends on whether or not they perceive that their time is coming to a close and that they're going to have to make some changes in order to have any kind of ordered society at all. You know, this dominant paradigm is leading us to destruction, and it obviously cannot continue. So what I'm offering is solutions that benefit everyone, and people are going to have to work out details for themselves, but it is going to be, I think, a more decentralized system of politics and economics. And, you know, Jane Jacobs, the economist, said that it is not national economies that are the salient entities. It's cities. It's cities that are the salient economic entities. And a national economy is simply an aggregation of city economies. So we have to look back toward the local level and do what needs to be done to support the health of communities. That's why I called my second book New Money for Healthy Communities, because this is the way we create healthy communities.
And it is, again, so timely, because we have been living in such alienation from each other in that almighty quest for consumerism, at all uncontrolled consumerism, and we get further and further away from that community awareness. So it is so timely. And as I said earlier, perhaps that's why it all comes down, so that we are called back to stirred, back to our humanity, stirred to action at the brink of really disaster.
Yes, and it depends on our recognizing the fact that we are not separate entities. There's a saying,
exactly,
that no man is an island. And we have become an atomistic society. Most of us don't even know our next-door neighbors. And so we pay a price for that. You know, this isolation is very costly to us. And if we're going to solve our problems, we're going to have to come together and cooperate and take advantage of the group intelligence and wisdom. It's said that two heads are better than one, and many heads are better still. So there's a tremendous process of reorganization that needs to take place, and that's what's going on across the globe. I mentioned
the transition.
And that
is a wonderfully optimistic thread that is woven through your work, that it looks like disaster, but underneath this breakdown is, as you said earlier, an incredible opportunity for us to reexamine the nature of human reality and
sure.
our role in community, in societies, and in the end, as caretakers of the world.
There's been a big movement in recent decades towards intentional communities, toward community building. The Transition Towns movement, which is gaining tremendous impetus, is spreading all over the world. And there are sustainability groups organizing. We have one in Tucson. It's called Sustainable Tucson. And it's an official transition town organization. And basically it brings people together to look at the problems that we have and to figure out together how we can move into the future in a sustainable fashion. Because we're facing this multidimensional crisis that I mentioned, resource depletion, peak oil, global warming, all of these things, breakdown of institutions, and so it's a clear indication things need to change and are changing.
That I'll drink to that, as they say. Let me ask you this. For the individual who is listening today and is motivated to learn more, besides your own blog and the information you put out, where does the one who lives in California and wants to seek out this kind of sustainable organization, how do they go about finding out more information relevant to their communities?
You can go to Transition Towns USA. That'll give you a rundown of the various transition town movements in this country, or wherever you happen to live. If it's in Europe, just Google Transition Towns. You'll find a connection.
That'll get you started. It'll get you plugged in, won't it?
Yes.
Okay, can you get that, people? It's Transitions Town, Transition
no,
Towns.
Transition
Towns. Or
I'm not
Google
sure
that.
Of the URL, but if you Google it, you'll find it.
Okay.
Also, from the business standpoint, there's something called the Business Alliance for Local Living Economy, BALLE, B-A-L-L-E. That has been growing over the last several years and involves mainly small and medium-sized businesses around the United States, businesses that have a different kind of vision and a different kind of motivation and are looking at how to compete with the big box stores and national chains and how to move into a sustainable economy and produce things that people need and get them distributed adequately. So that's another thing that you can look at.
People, listen to these words of wisdom. Know that you can look at this crisis in two ways, destruction and despair or opportunity. And I have been speaking to a very wise economist, Thomas Greco, who has been looking at this as the opportunity for immense change at a time when we know we are shifting away from the old and into a new paradigm. Thomas, have you got a last message for our listeners before we sign out today?
Well, I guess I would remind people that they should get involved in their own communities, get to know their neighbors, plant some gardens in their backyard, take responsibility for their own health, and learn as much as you can about what's going on so that you can be part of the change and not part of the problem.
All right. To quote, I don't know who was the person who said it originally, be the change you want the world to be.
Exactly.
And with that thought, I'm going to start to sign out, unfortunately, because we've only barely scratched the surface with our wonderful guest, Thomas Greco. His website again is?
reinventingmoney.com, and the blog is beyondmoney.net.
Okay, the book is The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. It has so much wisdom in it. It helps you as an individual start to reactivate your engines, get into the positive mindset of seeing what's breaking down as the necessary process for what will emerge from the chrysalis. And with that, Thomas, I want to thank you wholeheartedly for sharing. Would you come back on?
Certainly. It's been my pleasure, Patricia, and I commend you for the good work that you're doing.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I, of course, commend you. And I would love to have you back on so that we can take it to the next step, because an hour, which we were robbed of a few minutes of, is not enough time with you. So thank you very much. Please, people, go out and investigate Thomas's important work. He is a Renaissance man looking to a future of great change, great promise, and a field of possibility where we human beings can rise to the greatness that we know we're capable of. Okay? With that, I have to leave you. I'm in Glastonbury. In a couple of days, I'm off to the crop circles. I'm going to have lots to tell you. In the meantime, thank you for tuning in. If you want to share this interview with your friends, which I think is a very good idea, please tune back in Saturday at 10 a.m. California time. This interview will be aired again. So anyone that you know is grappling with these issues, get them to the web radio on bbsradio.com and listen again to this interview with one of the minds of our future, Thomas Greco. Thank you, Thomas. All right, everybody, that's it. Tuning out now, and I will be back with you next week with more insights into what lies beyond the Matrix.